school's in session. If you neglected to sign in, please do. Every time you sign in, City College gets paid. And that enables these free courses. And enables City College to stay extant in a time of shrinking undergraduate enrollments. So you're making up for the fact that the kids are going to work instead of going to school. To a slight extent, anyway. So please do sign in every time. If you're not registered, see me, and we'll get you registered. But I think at this point, pretty much everybody is on the bus. Okay, several announcements. First of all, I'm sorry I can't say personally hello to everybody each Friday morning, but hello to you collectively, and I know you're here for two reasons. Reason one is because every week I have to check off who is here into the computer, and that makes me aware that you are here, and also because, strangely enough, sitting here, I kind of look at everybody, and so I kind of see who's here. So I know you're here even if I don't say hello. If you haven't said hello to me personally, if I don't know who you are, I can't match your name and face, come up and tell me who you are, so that when I sit here, I don't feel like an idiot looking at people that I don't know. Okay? So if that is the case, please do come introduce yourself. That way, every week when I check you off, I'll know who I'm entering into the computer. In 2 weeks, please bring writing materials, which means something to write with, a hard surface to write on, and some paper. Because if I do what I think I'm going to do in 2 weeks, it's going to be an exercise that we're going to do that you're going to need to do some writing for. And I'm not going to give you the exercise till after we have done the exercise. So you're going to need your own paper to begin with. So that's in 2 weeks.
Yeah. Something to hand in afterwards?
No. It's totally for you, but it's something that you're going to need to inscribe as we do the exercise. And mind and supermind. On November 5th, Gene Quainty is going to come and talk about iGen, the first generation to have had a smartphone in their hands at least since they began adolescence, and the younger ones since they began. And the question is that changing them? And is that changing society? And the answer, as you well know, is yes. And the question is how much? And the answer is more than you think. And, actually, we're going to explore that a little next week also, because the election is coming up, so I thought we'd talk a little bit about neuropolitics and what is happening to the supposed democratic structure of our country. So we're going to talk about that next week. But Gene Quainty is the acknowledged expert on what's happening to the youth. She wrote the book iGen, that is was a New York Times bestseller. I don't know if it still is.
I just want to say something about the neuropolitics thing. Yesterday, the SAGE talk at UCSB was by this computer scientist showing how you can just create fake videos.
I'm actually going to talk about that. So don't steal my thunder, because next week I'm actually going to talk about it. This is all cribbed from Technology Review. It's all tech from the Tech Review. Like I've abridged the one on neuropolitics.
Could you repeat the name of her book?
Oh, iGen. I-G-E-N. And then it's a long subtitle. But I-G-E-N. And her name is Gene Quainty. T-W-E-N-G-E.
I don't feel so bad. I didn't miss you.
Is that with a small I?
Yes, small I, capital G-E-N. Small I, capital G-E-N. iGen. That's her book. But better, if you're going to go, get tickets, because there's only a limited amount of tickets available to the public, because a bunch of programs have grabbed a lot of the tickets, and so I'm not sure if there are going to be tickets. Also, tickets at the door are more expensive than tickets purchased earlier. So any question on anything before we get going?
Oh, you had people
what the artwork for the last class.
Say again?
What the artwork.
Oh, yeah, okay, thank you. Thank you, Julie. Please remember to bring in your artwork for our November 9th, I think it is, class, our last class. And place it around the room and we'll look at it. And I think that last class will focus especially on some cool artwork. So I'm going to show you some on screen and we'll see some around. So bring your artwork on November 9th and place it around the room.
I'd rather yell. Okay. Okay, so about mindfulness. First of all, the 1, 2, 3 instructions, just because you haven't heard them 4 trillion times already. Instruction 1, breathe. Instruction 2, soften and open at every level progressively. And 3 is notice whatever you notice without trying to do anything about it. We're going to focus on number 3 today, the notice whatever you notice without trying to do anything about it. So Jack Kornfield, whom pretty much probably everyone knows, is a prominent mindfulness teacher in the West, learned mindfulness in the 1970s in Southeast Asia. He graduated from Dartmouth and he went immediately to Southeast Asia and sat in monasteries a lot and learned mindfulness and then realized that this was something that everybody ought to know about, and so he brought it back to the United States, and starting in about 1974, I think, is when he came back. And he has taught me, and he's taught a lot of folks, and a lot of folks have taught a lot of folks, so he's really kind of been seminal in the dissemination of mindfulness. Anyway, he tells a story about one of his teachers, Achen Cha. And apparently, Achen Cha would walk around the monastery looking at people meditate. And when he saw somebody that was having a very difficult time, that was suffering, which happens sometimes when you meditate, stuff comes up, you know, and you cry, and it's not all easy what you discover. So when he would look at these folks, and he would see they were suffering, he would say really gently, "Must be very attached. Must be very attached," he would gently say to the person, kind of remind them about what mindfulness is. What he was alluding to is the direct link between attachment and suffering. The more attachment, the more suffering. The more you care about something, the more possibility there is that if it doesn't go the way you want it to go, you will suffer. I'm not going where you think I'm going, by the way. I'm going beyond where you think I'm going with this. Okay. So I don't know which meditation teacher, which Buddhist, famous Buddhist said this, though one of you might, but when asked about what Buddhism has to teach, this famous teacher said 4 words: no self, no problem. Anybody remember who did? I would love to know. Where's Gordon? Gordon, do you know this?
Yeah.
Who's...
Ruth Gordon?
No. Gordon Stubtel knows everything. Gordon, do you know who said that?
Yeah, I think
who said no self, no problem?
Right.
Who said it?
No, I have no idea.
Okay, because I figured if anybody knew, you would know, Gordon.
They can Google it.
We could just Google it. Yeah, if somebody is sitting in the back of the room with their hair with their hat turned back, looking out the window, as my students do, whenever I ask a question, the person who is the least interested, the most out the window, raises his hand 30 seconds later and says, "The answer is blah, blah, blah." Because what they're doing back there is they're sneaking their phone, you know, and they're like, so they just get, yeah, anything. I said, I remember saying one time, "God, I don't remember what the phobia of the number 13 is." And this guy, who had never spoken before in class, probably in his entire life, raised his hand from the back of the room with his hat turned back, and he said, "Triskaidekaphobia." And they said, how did you know that? And he said, pick up his phone.
So there's a book called No Salt, No Problem, Awakening to Our True Nature. And that is by Anam Thubten, T-H-U-B-T-E-N.
Okay,
does
so
that mean he came up with it?
No, I don't think so. I think that it's a traditional saying that he put as the title to his book. Okay, so no self, no problem. That sounds really good. You know, if you're not attached to anything, if it's all just out there in front of you, then you don't have any problem. But you don't have any self. You don't have any life, okay? Okay, so we're going to come back to that conundrum, which is if you follow Buddhism strictly, it leads to a place that you might not want to go. But let's leave it there and follow Buddhism a little bit further. Buddha is this supposed guy who, at age of 28 or 29, woke up, and the Buddha means the one who woke up, and walked around India for 40 years and taught. And what did he teach? The Four Noble Truths. What are the Four Noble Truths? In my casting of them, they are as follows. Noble Truth number one, unenlightened life is full of suffering. Noble Truth number two, there is a way out of suffering. Suddenly we're paying more attention. You know? Noble Truth number three, and this is my translation of it. The way out of, the Buddhists would say, the way out of suffering is non-attachment. But I would say, because that's something not to do, it's kind of hard. My way to say it is, the way out of suffering is letting go into the present moment. The way out of suffering is letting go into the present moment. The suffering involves thinking about the future or the past. Okay. In the present moment, there might be pain, but there's not suffering. That's a mental construction having to do with future and past. So the way out of suffering is to let go into the present moment. And the fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Way, which is if you want to be able to let go into the present moment, live your life this way. Because if you lie, cheat, and steal, you're going to have too much on your mind to be able to let go into the present moment. So the Eightfold Path is really a way to allow yourself to open into what is. Okay? It's just a prescription for how you comport yourself so that you can do that release.
Okay? Did you say number four again?
The Eightfold Path, which is a prescription for how to be able to let go into the present moment. Okay. Okay. Some of you, I actually have read, we have read portions of this together in class, but I'm just going to read the first stanza of the Great Way, a long poem that many of you are familiar with, written by Sengstan, the third Zen patriarch, in the 6th century AD, I think it was, but it might have been 7th century AD. But let me find that out.
See.
It's called Sinsin Ming, is what it's called in Chinese, but it's called The Great Way. If you Google The Great Way is not difficult, up will come many different graphic versions of this wonderful, enigmatic, long poem, which if you don't know what mindfulness is, makes no sense at all, and if you do know what mindfulness is, makes perfect sense. But anyway, this is Buddhism's purest statement in a nutshell. And then we're going to talk about why we have to crack that nut. Okay? But here we go. The great, so if you really want to get free from suffering, the great way, that is the enlightened way, the way of no suffering, the great way is not difficult for those who hold no preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the slightest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. So what they're saying here is what causes your difficulty, what causes you to not see reality is your fear and your hope, the things that you project onto it, the way you try to manipulate it to be more like you want it to be. What they say is all you have to do to be enlightened is stop doing that. Stop having your mind go, I want this, I don't want this, what about this, I don't, you know. Stop putting clouds over the sun of reality and just let the sun of reality shine in whatever way it's shining. That's Buddhism in its purest form. But if you don't have, now I'm going to take issue. Okay, we're Western people. We're not Eastern people who are collective in our nature and who have been practicing letting go of the individual self. We've been practicing building a strong sense of self. That's the West, becoming more healthy as a self. So the Western hybrid of pure Buddhism and Western psychology philosophy, which is to succeed as an individual, okay? The hybrid of that, which is evolving, is what I want to talk to you about is the way we, most of us are going, which is we don't want no attachment because if there's no suffering, there's also no joy. If you don't care, you don't have any, oh, but you don't have any yay. And most of us want a life. We just don't want a life with too much suffering, right? Yeah. So the deal is, the Western hybrid of Buddhism and Western psychology / philosophy is regulate your attachment so that you have adequate, you have appropriate attachment for the situation you're in. That opens you to suffering to the degree that you're attached, but it also opens you to real joy to the degree that you're attached. So for the things that you love, the people that you love, you probably have a lot of attachment and you don't want to not care. You know, there's a Zen story about the guy who adopts, the Zen master who adopts the young child because the young child is abandoned and nobody will take her or him. So the Zen master says, I'll take it, and raises this child. And then many years later, as the child has become a young adult, somebody comes and says, you know, I left that child, that's my child. I want my child back. And the Zen master says, good. No attachment. Most of us are kind of not there, right? So the point about it is realize that you're attached to certain things and that's going to involve joy and suffering, and you elect that. But how many things are we attached to that aren't worth the suffering and don't give you that much joy? Okay? And so when you're mindful, you get to look at what you're grasping. Let me finish here. You get to look at what you're grasping, what you're holding on to or what you're pushing away. That's grasping in Buddhism. And you get to see to what extent you're attached to various things, and then you get to decide how much attachment is appropriate for this thing. Do I need to let go? And a lot of time we find we need to let go of stuff that we're clinging to for dear life, and it's squeezing the life out of us. Okay. So, Robert.
I'm a little confused because the thing that you just read said that if you have the slightest attachment, then you lose everything.
Yeah, I know, but all or nothing thinking is a disease of the mind. So the point is, when you're sitting in meditation, when you're being mindful, in particular, then you realize to what extent you're attached to various things, and you realize how much suffering is coming from that, and you can let go of attachments that you don't choose to have, or you can regulate how attached you are. Simple as that. Okay, so Abraham, and then Chris, and then we're going to sit. Okay.
I think what he meant by non-attachment is not to own anything, but not to allow whatever you own make you possessive.
That what you just said is the Western hybrid. Okay, that is, you know, you want to own stuff and you want to care about it, but you don't want to let it rule your life. Yeah. So what we're doing is we're melding these two opposite kind of philosophies into a really viable life philosophy, which is what's happening right now in this class. And right now in California, and right now in this country, right now in this world, is these two streams, West and East, come together into this new understanding. Chris.
How does the East reconcile taking a stand on justice? Would you walk by a woman being raped and say, let it be? You know, I mean,
That's always been the question that the West has asked the East, is, are you okay with what people being unjust to other people and hurting other people? We have to do something about this. And the answer is yeah. But if you are so concerned with what's happening in the world that's unjust, then you will suffer and you will probably not be effective at changing things. You know how people that are really, 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 really caught up in the nastiness of the world, what's wrong with the world, kind of go crazy? You know, the idea would be to care as much as is viable for you without losing your vitality and joy of life. But to not care, that's a little bit not responsible for other people, too.
Well, it's a lack of empathy.
Oh, but I don't want to go to Mahayana versus Hinayana Buddhism, but Mahayana Buddhism, the great vehicle, says you not only have to enlighten yourself, you have to enlighten everything and everybody. Yeah. So there is, and Buddhism not only talks about mindfulness, it talks about metta, compassion. Mm-hmm. So actually, the Buddhists aren't so pure about just letting go. Okay. All right. So 1, 2, 3. Then we got to sit. I got a whole thing that's not going to fit today. Okay.
What you just said kind of sounds like the difference between being against something or being for something. Whereas if you identify with being against it, destroy you much quicker, I think, than being for something.
But being for something also involves some level of caring about how it comes out. So there is some karma attached. Okay. Dennis, and then Christina, and then we're going to sit.
I was thinking attachment and moderation.
Yeah, moderation. Remember Buddha's teaching about the middle path? Not no caring, not too much caring. Christina.
I'm just thinking that whenever I'm around Buddhist monks, that I just feel this incredible love and compassion. And I think there's a way to have love and and be unattached.
They see, if there's a possibility to do that, they seem to be the epitome of that, because they have a very open heart and they spend their life in service, and at the same time they don't seem like they're struggling so much.
They're in the present.
Yeah. But yes, there certainly is caring. And I'm sure there is some suffering, because you know, the Dalai Lama cries when he hears about stuff happening in the world. I mean, because he cares. You know? All right, let's sit, okay? So, let's sit for 10 minutes. So, another thing about mindfulness is you don't try to change yourself. You just take a step back from what is happening, and that creates the change. So instead of saying, well, I gotta stop being attached to that, how do I stop being attached to that? Just let everything be as it is, and find your breathing, and that brings you one step back, and just notice how the system is working, and it will self-correct. Okay? Don't sit there going, self-improvement, self-improvement. Don't even sit there going, no self, no self. Just breathe and open and open and breathe and notice what is. So let's sit for 10 minutes. Set up the chairs. Thank you. All right, so being efficient. I'm going to show you two videos and comment on them. The first of the two I need to preface with, it's very short, 6 minutes, and I need to preface it with a very short story, which is one time I was sitting talking to Sophie the Golden Retriever, my favorite non-human and maybe favorite creature in the world, and I was talking baby talk. Oh, you're so cute. Oh, you're such a wonderful, you know. And she's sitting there, looking out at the world, looking over at me, and something just clicked in my mind. And I went, oh my God, I'm talking baby talk to a fully developed creature who's been evolving for as long as I've been evolving and is equally intelligent to me, just differently intelligent, and is perfectly suited for her station in the ecosystem, just like I'm perfectly suited for mine, sort of. She's probably better at hers than I am at mine. And I thought, you know, why am I considering that I'm the top of the evolutionary ladder and that she's somewhere down seven rungs, okay? With that preamble, let's look at somebody talking about, now I don't know where he teaches. I don't know where he teaches because I didn't bother to research that. But this is a TED Talk about evolution. It might change your view of what evolution is. We'll need to have these things closed if we could. Yeah. Yeah, leave the window, I mean, good. That's what gets closed, but the door stays open because we need the air. And his name is Prasanta Chakrabarty. Okay. And isn't it nice to have a screen you can actually see?
Yeah.
Okay, here we go. Volume, let's go down.
We evolved from monkeys, why are there still monkeys? Well, because we're not monkeys, we're fish. Now, knowing you're a fish and not a monkey is actually really important to understanding where we came from. I teach one of the largest evolutionary biology classes in the US, and when my students finally understand why I call them fish all the time, then I know I'm getting my job done. But I always have to start my classes by dispelling some hardwired myths. Because without really knowing it, many of us were taught evolution wrong. For instance, we're taught to say the theory of evolution. There are actually many theories, and just like the process itself, the ones that best fit the data are the ones that survive to this day. The one we know best is Darwinian natural selection. That's the process by which those organisms that best fit an environment survive and get to reproduce, while those that are less fit slowly die off. And that's it. Evolution is as simple as that, and it's a fact. Evolution is a fact as much as the theory of gravity, and you can prove it just as easily. You just need to look at your belly button that you share with other placental mammals, or your backbone that you share with other vertebrates, or your DNA that you share with all other life on Earth. Those traits didn't pop up in humans. They were passed down from different ancestors to all their descendants, not just us. But that's not really how we learn biology early on, is it? We learn plants and bacteria are primitive things, and fish give rise to amphibians, followed by reptiles and mammals, and then you get you, this perfectly evolved creature at the end of the line. So life doesn't evolve in a line, and it doesn't end with us. But we're always shown evolution portrayed something like this, a monkey and a chimpanzee, some extinct humans, all on a forward and steady march to becoming us. But they don't become us any more than we would become them. We're also not the goal of evolution. But why does it matter? Why do we need to understand evolution the right way? Well, misunderstanding evolution has led to many problems, but you can't ask that question, that age-old question, where are we from, without understanding evolution the right way. Misunderstanding it has led to many convoluted and corrupted views of how we should treat other life on Earth and how we should treat each other in terms of race and gender. So let's go back 4 billion years. This is the single-celled organism we all came from. At first, they gave rise to other single-celled life, but these are still evolving to this day. And some would say the archaea and bacteria that make up most of this group is the most successful on the planet. They're certainly going to be here well after us. About 3 billion years ago, multicellularity evolved. This includes your fungi, your plants, and your animals. The first animals to develop a backbone were fishes. So technically, all vertebrates are fishes. So technically, you and I are fish. So don't say I didn't warn you. One fish lineage came onto land and gave rise to, among other things, the mammals and reptiles. Some reptiles become birds. Some mammals become primates. Some primates become monkeys with tails. And others become the great apes, including a variety of human species. So you see, we didn't evolve from monkeys, but we do share a common ancestor with them. All the while, life around us kept evolving. More bacteria, more fungi, lots of fish. If you couldn't tell, but yes, they're my favorite group. As life evolves, it also goes extinct. Most species just last for a few million years. So you see, most life on Earth that we see around us today are about the same age as our species. So it's hubris. It's self-centered to think, oh, plants and bacteria are primitive, and we've been here for an evolutionary minute, so we're somehow special. Think of life as being this book, an unfinished book for sure. We're just seeing the last few pages of each chapter. If you look out on the 8 million species that we share this planet with, think of them as all being 4 billion years of evolution. They're all the product of that. Think of us all as young leaves on this ancient and gigantic tree of life. All of us connected by invisible branches, not just to each other, but to our extinct relatives and our evolutionary ancestors. As a biologist, I'm still trying to learn with the others how everyone's related to each other, who is related to whom. Perhaps it's better still to think of us as a little fish out of water. Yes, one that learned to walk and talk, but one that still has a lot of learning to do about who we are and where we came from. Thank you.
Join President Bill Clinton.
I turn on lights for a minute, but I'm not going to turn them off for very long. Until the range is lower. Okay, so that's enough light for now. Are there any comments about, what's his?
Can you please repeat his name?
No. His name is, okay, you go to Ted.
Chakrabarty.
Yeah. C-H-A, C-H-A.
What chakra?
Chakra, C-H-A-K-R-A. C-H-A-K-R-A-B-A-R-T-Y. Chakrabarty. So any comment on that? Anything you want to say? Dennis.
Why do we need to know the past? I don't think you got into that much. Why is it so important that we know that?
OK.
Can you repeat the question?
Dennis's question is, why do we need to know the past? Why is it so important? Paula, what do you want to say? Loud.
Well, I can say one reason is because if we don't understand the past, then we do things like have slavery or perform medical experiments on Jews because we believe that they are subhuman and therefore, and all of vivisection and all of use of animals, but it seems easier for people to understand how we treat other humans than how we treat non-human animals, not subhuman animals, as you pointed out, and as he pointed out. So if we don't understand the theory of how we got here and who we are, that puts us in a position of being able to do very evil and cruel things. I think that might be one answer.
Ah, thank you. That's, I think, a good answer. Okay, so it's Krista?
Krista.
Yeah, Krista. Okay, and then go.
I think not so much we need to know the past as we need to know the whole. And the whole is inclusive of that, to have a whole perspective. Also, hindsight is 20/20, so it's great to be able to look at something with, you know, 20/20 vision and then notice the patterns that continue and how we want to, you know, how we interrelate with that. But what I love what he said, that evolution is not linear. Like, this universe is not linear. It is so multidimensional. So to have us at the end of a line is the same as the old theories of astronomy where the Earth, the eco or ecocentric, was at the center of the solar system. It's just a very immature kind of perspective. So we want to expand that.
Yeah, beautifully said. Could you hear? Because I can't. Okay, so you have to broadcast, folks, or otherwise I can give you a mic if you need. Another answer to the question of why we need to know the past is so we don't make the same mistake again, which is if we know the past, we realize that species don't generally last very long, right? And we realize that we're on that same trajectory, so unless we want to go the same route that a lot of other species went, like Neanderthals, for example, then we better understand the pattern so we can change it. So history is important not only for the for understanding the past, it's important for understanding the future and affecting the future. Who's next? Okay, Anine.
If we don't understand our evolutionary history, we tend to have a human-centric point of view and miss out on the fullness of life.
Yeah, that's essentially what he was saying, is if you don't understand that everything's been evolving for as long, then you think that we're at the top and we can exploit not only creatures that are not human, but also other branches of humanity, which we see as less evolved as we are. You know, people make war, when you make war on somebody else, you cast them as subhuman or less than human, and that justifies your dominating them. Well, anyway, there's a bunch of answers to that. Let's now go to this next and a little more challenging video, thanks to Amy, who sent this to me and said, I don't know about this, and I sent back, I looked at it and I said, I don't know about this, and I saw it, and then I saw it a second time and I thought, you know, this is worth not knowing about, okay? So, this class, there's a guy, when this class used to be on Tuesday mornings, there was a guy sitting in this class who used to call it a great Tuesday morning headache. Because we would consider stuff that would, oh my God, try to get your head around that. Well, this is it. Okay. What I'm going to do is I'm going to stop it at a bunch of points and just kind of translate as best I can, but some of it I don't know and some of it I don't understand. So it's 25 minutes long. We'll go through it and then we can kind of ponder it all together. What I do know is whether or not I understand it, it's worth trying to understand it. Okay? What he's saying, even if it's not entirely correct or comprehensible, is certainly compelling and alluring and provoking. So I got to define a couple of terms for you, just because he's going to do them, but I want to make sure that you get them because they're so fundamental. One term is synergy, which is when you put one and one together, you get more than two. When you combine different things. Sometimes when you bring them together, you get something that exceeds either of them or the sum of them. Somehow they come together and they make more. That's called synergy. And sometimes what they make is fundamentally different than they are. You put one and one together, and they make three, but the three is somehow has different properties than the one and the one. You put stuff together, you put this together and you put that together, and what emerges is something that has different properties from this or that. Those are called emergent properties. Things that you can't predict from the two things you're putting together. They come out of the two things you're putting together and they're new. They somehow are not predictable from what composed them. So synergy is when stuff comes together and it makes more than the sum of the parts. And emergence is, or emergent properties are the things that are unpredictable, the new that come out of that coming together, okay?
Sounds like evolution.
Well, yeah, it does sound like evolution, and that's what we're talking about, but in another sense, okay? So, by the way, this is, I don't know how you found this, because this is not a popular video. Less than 10,000 people have seen this video since it's been posted. So you're in the privileged few here. One more thing I gotta tell you, which is, you gotta forgive the fact that he uses the F word a lot. Okay. This is a perfect talk, except for the fact that he throws the F bomb every once in a while, and it really, I wish that he didn't, because this talk I think would be much more universally, a lot more people would be able to watch it if not. So please ignore the fact that he talks in a different way than we do, but not necessarily than the kids do. They don't use that word quite the same way. Okay, so let me get it on first. And let me get it on. Okay, I gotta say one more thing about this, as long as we're talking about the F word. If you're really from New York, then you realize that's just a syllable that you insert between other syllables. You don't say how are you, you say how the F are you. Good F morning, you know, that's just the way that you talk. So
Gibson.
Fuck that. All right, so here we go. How about that? Okay. Here we go. All right, so fasten your seatbelts and put on your thinking caps here. So this guy's name is Daniel Schmachtenberger. But don't hold it against him. Here we go. Okay.
And it has to be good.
What I want to talk about today is what emergence is as a phenomenon, as a property that's actually essential to understand the nature of the universe we live in, and that's actually essential to understand what it means to be human, and that is essential for understanding the basis for meaning, for ethics, for existentialism, and then also what that portends for the future of civilization and addressing some of the things that are concerning and that are exciting. Okay, so you can consider the next 20 minutes or however long this is as kind of an extemporaneous, rambling ode to emergence itself, right? A kind of love talk about how cool it is that the universe actually has this property and that we can understand and participate with it. So let's start with defining. What is emergence? Emergence means something new arises that wasn't here before. Right? We all kind of have that sense intuitively. But scientifically, how the fuck does that happen? How do you bring particles or planets or anything together and all of a sudden the whole has some properties that none of the parts have? Where do they come from? Which is why in the fields of science that study emergence, which evolutionary theory and biology and system science and complexity theory study it, it's considered the closest thing to magic. It's actually a scientifically kind of admissible term, but it's still sketchy, right, in terms of the really understanding how this thing works. And because how do we get fundamentally new things out of relationships of things where that didn't exist before? This is fascinating. How do you have a cell that respirates made up of molecules, none of whom respirate? And so it's just really interesting when you actually think about this, right? We have a coin, a paired term. Does anyone know what the term is that is key in understanding synergy? And emergence is synergy. Synergy and emergence are two sides of the same phenomenon. Synergy means whole that's greater than the sum of its parts. Emergence is what is that greater? It is what is the new stuff that emerges out of bringing things together. And so synergy is more formally defined as properties of whole systems that aren't found in any of the parts taken separately, which also means that are fundamentally unpredicted by the parts taken separately, which portends a future that is fundamentally, ontologically unpredictable from the current state of the future, which is very different than a mechanistic clock unfolding Newtonian understanding of the future.
What he just said is we can't predict the future because there are all these parts that are interacting, and out of this will come unpredictable new qualities. Okay, so the universe is an emergent phenomenon. And you know, that's what quantum physics says, is you kind of can't tell what's going to happen next, given that you know what's happening now. There's a fundamental unknown about it. There's a probability about it, but we can't tell, given this, what's going to come next. So physics says that.
So. And yet it still actually makes sense in terms of scientific law. Super interesting, right? So synergy is this property of relationship where the whole has new properties that the parts didn't have. So emergence is a result of synergy. Synergy is a result of relationship. Does that make sense? And relationship is a result of attractive forces.
Do you like the closed caption or is it distracting?
Yes, no.
Perfect.
No,
I really like it.
Leave the closed caption?
Yes.
Okay.
Like
okay.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so here we go. Hopefully it'll be good translation. You know, it's a machine translation, so sometimes it doesn't work. Okay, so. All right, here's where we get to the attractive forces thing. This is a one that I gotta listen to again. Here we go.
Gents is a result of synergy. Synergy is a result of relationship. Does that make sense? And relationship is a result of attractive forces. There are some kinds of attractive forces, whether it's gravity bringing dust together into planets or planets together in solar systems, whether it's electromagnetism bringing subatomic particles together into atoms, or the strong force bringing quarks together into protons. Each of those are emergent properties driven by synergy, driven by relationship, driven by attraction. Or whether it's bringing these people together via pheromones, or love, or intellectual affinity, or a topic that we're all interested in, like creating a better world. There's some attractive forces. And so Bucky Fuller called...
Before Bucky Fuller. So what he's saying is the universe is made up of relationship. And relationship is an attraction between two things. Right? And out of these relationships come these emergent properties. So back to Bucky Fuller. Here we go.
Or love, or intellectual affinity, or a topic that we're all interested in, like creating a better world. There's some attractive forces. And so Bucky Fuller called love metaphysical gravity. In the same way that gravity and physical forces act on physical bodies to attract them, we have metaphysical forces that act on metaphysical bodies to drive attraction. But think about, so imagine if you think about all of the attractive forces as expressions of a fundamental principle of universal allurement, that there is a principle by which separate things have reason to come together that offers advantage that being separate doesn't have. And you think about all of the forces and special case applications of that. Imagine if that wasn't the case. Imagine if we had a universe where allurement wasn't a fundamental principle of it. And the whole thing would have stopped at quantum foam. Right? You have quantum foam emerge, you don't even quite get to the point of subatomic particle, and that's it, because nothing attracts to then have synergy and emergent properties. I have a friend and collaborator, Mark Gaffney, who calls this universe a love story. Why at the heart of the evolutionary story is this love story, which is that it's actually attraction driving the whole fucking evolutionary story, right? Attraction driving relationship, driving synergy, driving new emergent properties, driving net novelty and new creation, and the arrow of evolution. So we can actually understand the arrow of evolution itself in terms of this set of phenomena together. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So then evolution in complexity theory is defined most generally in terms of more elegantly ordered complexity. That's actually the best definition we have in terms of mathematical complexity theory coming out of Santa Fe Institute. The definition has the word elegance built right in it, because it's, again, one of these actually fairly mysterious properties, but that's key to it, which is bringing things together doesn't give you emergent properties. Bringing them together in a particularly elegantly ordered way does. So think about all the parts that make up a cell, right? You've got all these non-living parts, DNA and cell nucleus structures and all the different organelles and cytoplasm, and they're all not living. And then the cell is living. But if you brought all those parts together, but you didn't arrange them as a cell, it was just a bunch of molecules, it wouldn't be that interesting, right? It'd just be goo. If you took the 50 trillion cells that made you and you didn't arrange them exactly this way, and you just had like 150 pounds worth of cells, it would be much less interesting. Even though there'd be just as much complexity, you wouldn't have an order in the complexity where the emergent property comes. That's actually the relationship. It's not just heaps coming together. It's not just complexity, it's wholes. And the difference between a whole and a heap is order, and a specific set of patterns of order. This means not every relationship is synergistic. Some relationships are entropic. They actually create the opposite direction of new emergent properties. They destroy some properties that were already there. Right? Almost everyone has some examples. But you bring chemicals together that, rather than self-organizing to create higher ordered molecules with new thermodynamic properties, they have an exothermic entropic reaction and they drop to lower levels of organization, right? This is true at all levels. So it's not just relationship, it's specific kinds of relationship that maximize synergy. This is a key thing to understand about the nature of the universe. It's also the case that if you bring the same thing together, a bunch of the same thing, you don't get very interesting synergies. You get very interesting synergies when you bring different things with different properties together in the right format, where then you have the properties of each of those things and then the properties of the relationship between those, which is the new stuff, and you get emergence. So you've got hydrogen and you've got oxygen, which are different things, and you bring them together and you get water, the basis for life, but neither hydrogen nor oxygen at room temperature are liquids.
So this is, you can look at this not only in terms of physical things, you can look at this in terms of social things. If you bring diverse groups of people together in the right situation, you get the emergent property of a healthy United States, because of all these different groups coming in and sometimes not so harmoniously dealing with one another, but eventually coming together into an emergent phenomenon, which is a country with no one single ethnic or religious background, which creates a great vitality, right? Well, has created a great vitality anyway. Okay, so let's go back and get
rid of it. Is of each of those things, and then the properties of the relationship between those, which is the new stuff, and you get emergent. So you've got hydrogen and you've got oxygen, which are different things. You bring them together and you get water, the basis for life, but neither hydrogen nor oxygen at room temperature are liquids, right? And so this is a fascinating thing. So we're actually very interested in having deep synergistic relationships with differences that lead to fundamentally new emerging properties. So it's not just net complexity, it's ordered complexity, and it's elegantly ordered complexity. And then when you get a new property, then universe selects for that, right? That new property offers some evolutionary advantage to that system that a system that didn't have that wouldn't have. So things can come together all kinds of ways, but the ones that come together most synergistically offer and confer the most advantage, and universe selects for it. So universe is actually selecting for more differences, right? So it's selecting for diversity and then more synergistic combinations across those differences. And it's both of those, more diversity and more unification across the diversity, right? more agency and more symbiosis at the same time is what defines the era of evolution. Does that make sense?
So that's a pretty cool thing, and I'm going to play it again if you can hear it. But the idea is, if you bring two same things together, you don't get much new emergent property. But if you bring very different things together in an order, in a particular way, then what can come out is something really interesting and new, and that conveys some advantage. So if I were running a startup, I would want to bring together quite different, or if I were doing, if I were trying to do research on some important topic, I would bring together a bunch of different disciplines to dialogue. And out of that might come a very a new and better way to deal with that problem or to create that product. Robert.
I mean, I generally agree, but I would say the creation of diamond out of carbon is kind of an exception.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, there's a bunch of exceptions here, but the basic point is that, well, let's go back, let's let him talk about it again. That last point is really crucial. If you, in the right way, bring very different things together, then you get emergent properties that give the new creation an advantage, an evolutionary advantage. So let's go back to this.
Go back here a little bit. Go back there.
Here we go.
With differences that lead to fundamentally new emerging properties. So it's not just net complexity, it's ordered complexity, and it's elegantly ordered complexity, and then when you get a new property, then universe selects for that, right? That new property offers some evolutionary advantage to that system that a system that didn't have that wouldn't have. So things can come together all kinds of ways, but the ones that come together most synergistically offer and confer the most advantage, and universe selects for it. So universe is actually selecting for more differences, right? So it's selecting for diversity and then more synergistic combinations across those differences, that, and it's both of those, more diversity and more unification across the diversity, right? More agency and more symbiosis at the same time is what defines the era of evolution. Does that make sense? Things that are separate, autonomous agents, right? So like a cell, you can think of as having its own agency, right? Its own ability to act and its own boundary and periphery. But you bring a bunch of cells together, and this collection of cells can reflect on consciousness and existentialism and have a conversation like this, even though none of those cells on their own do that, right? And it's different kinds of cells. You couldn't do that with just neurons. It takes neurons and glial cells and immune cells and stem cells, et cetera, to all come together. So more agency, more differentiation, more orderly relationship, more synergy, all of that comes together, and the net defining thing is emergence. How much fundamental new advantage arises, and that's what evolution selects for. And so if it wasn't for this whole combination of things together, is this the message that says 5 minutes left? Fascinating. So
he ignores it.
So I'll see if we can go very quickly through, that was the first 1% of what I hoped to discuss. So I'm going to just skim over the top of a bunch of topics and hopefully paint a gestalt, at least, of an arc that's interesting.
Gestalt.
So the evolutionary universe story, the kind of new best story of universe we have emerging from the intersection of all the sciences, is that we have an evolutionary universe that doesn't require a creator agent, deistic or theistic god to create, but is also not just random, highly improbable set of movements that get us here, but there's a set of properties that give us a self-organizing, rather than creative agent, creative principle universe that is moving towards more elegant ordered complexity. And with that story on the physical, you also have the evolution of consciousness structures themselves, right? As you move from a reptilian nervous system to the increased orderly complexity of a mammalian, and then a neocortical, and then a prefrontal nervous system, you move from the kinds of sentience that map to that of pain, pleasure, reptilian, to emotional, to cognition, to abstraction. So we have a universe It's moving in the direction of not only more elegance, but greater depths and breadth of consciousness itself.
All right, so, okay, let me kind of, Abraham, and I'll translate.
Yeah, he was assuming that evolution has a mind to select. You know, he said that evolution selects it.
Yeah, by its nature. Okay, so nature by its nature. So let me talk about this. He says you don't need to assume a creator outside the universe in order to see how the universe is developing toward a more complexity and more consciousness. That the emergent properties that develop convey an evolutionary advantage, and so those properties then propagate more in the population, and then as that process continues, you get a more complex systems like you are, and more consciousness. So it doesn't, by the nature of the way that the universe works, it evolves. But it doesn't take anything outside that to direct that evolution. That's what he said. Okay. Ani, and then Betsy. Is it Betsy back there?
Yeah.
Okay, Ani, quick.
Very simplistically.
Loud.
Very simply, the creative principle is omnilocal. The creative principle is in everything that is. And it's how the relationships between everything that is interact is what the emergent properties, something emerges from that. That if it's elegant, if it's orderly, it's very difficult, but the creative principle is omnilocal, is in everything.
It's part of the nature of the universe to evolve.
Yes.
Okay, so Betsy and then Barry, and then
Rebecca. I think what he's saying is that life itself is self-organizing, like our bodies self-organize, the cells by themselves.
Yes.
The universe selects for greater and greater levels of organization.
Correct. And like as humanity, if we chose an organization where every enneotype was there, we'd have the differentiation of personality or identity to make life better and more emergent, and that we don't have to do anything about that except become aware of it and let the emergence happen. And our responsibility is to differentiate ourselves in terms of sensation, differentiate, in other words, our gardens, whatever we see, the more differentiation there is, the greater elegance will have in life, because the more emergent self-organization will occur.
And also, in terms of society, if we value diversity and encourage diversity rather than try to homogenize everybody, then we'll have a much more vital, emergent society.
Yes.
So Barry was next, and then Reed, and then we go back.
Yeah, I might be wrong, but it doesn't seem like much of a difference than Darwin was thinking, that he's just building upon.
Yeah, he's saying basically that what is more fit will survive. But he's unpacking that. He's showing how that process works. Let's see, Reed.
What is elegance?
You just can't throw stuff together. It doesn't, it just makes more, it makes a bigger heap. You have to bring stuff together in a particular way. And that's what they would call elegance, but he doesn't say more about it, and that's a great question. But the point is, remember what he said, is you just can't put two and two together and get more than four. You have to put it together in an elegant way.
The right way.
The right
way.
Yeah.
So those are all should be able to be broken down into some criteria. What is the right way? Describe the right way.
Oh.
Describe a particular way. Describe an elegant way.
I'm sure that actually people do that, and they're mathematicians and theoretical physicists, and they talk about how order comes out of complexity, how fractals happen, you know, all that kind of stuff. And that's what they work on, is what are the ordering principles. And a guy like Max Tegmark says, you get to the ordering principles and you get to God.
Right.
You get to the right. Okay, but look, we're going nowhere. So Betsy, and then you got to go back.
You say that you can experience elegance in your body when you differentiate sensations and you get up and you feel more of yourself and you walk better or you are, have a better stride. That's elegance. So you can embody what he's talking about.
So Betsy's talking, Betsy works as a body worker. She does Feldenkrais work. She says that if you just think of your body as a block, you're kind of a clot. But if you start to differentiate what all the different muscles and joints can do, then you reorder your body in a more efficient, elegant, graceful way. So by differentiating by the aspects of your motion, and then by bringing them together in an ordered, elegant fashion, you become more elegant, right?
Yes.
Okay, all right, let's go back to this. I'm gonna, he brought us on a history, he talked about how our nervous system evolves from basically just a brain stem which controls a body, to emotions, to thoughts, to abstraction. That's what he just brought us through. So let's listen to that again and then we'll go on.
The evolutionary universe story, the kind of new best story of universe we have emerging from the intersection of all the sciences, is that we have an evolutionary universe that doesn't require a creator agent, deistic or theistic god to create, but is also not just random, highly improbable set of movements that get us here, but there is a set of properties that give us a self-organizing, rather than creative agent, creative principle universe that is moving towards more elegant order of complexity. And with that story on the physical, you also have the evolution of consciousness structures themselves, right? As you move from a reptilian nervous system to the increased orderly complexity of a mammalian and then a neocortical and then a prefrontal nervous system, you move from the kinds of sentience that map to that of pain, pleasure, reptilian, to emotional, to cognition, to abstraction. So we have a universe it's moving in the direction of not only more elegance, but greater depths and breadth of consciousness itself. Now, this defines an era of evolution that reifies meaning in a very interesting way. And one of the things that's so interesting is with our capacity for abstraction, we can not just think about our experiential self of the moment, but we can think about ourselves in abstract terms. We can think about time abstractly, deep past and deep future, right? And that is what allows us to actually understand evolution itself. It's an understanding of deep past and fossil record and astrophysics that give us a sense of the ability to abstract the laws of how that change occurs over time that allows us a deeper insight as to how we got here, and then also the ability to vision a future fundamentally more beautiful and more interesting, and then be part of that creative process. So it's worthwhile just noting that our prefrontal cortex and our capacity for abstraction is a pretty new phenomenon evolutionarily, right? And it's also a very powerful set of capabilities. And when you have a new phenomena that's very powerful, you're not going to know how to use it that well. Many of its applications will be destructive until you figure it out. So we can think about the future as worry. We can think about the past as regret. We can think about self abstractly in terms of negative self-comparison. So then we have spiritual ideals emerge that basically say this is all bad, right? Mind and the ability for abstraction like this is bad. We should not think about the future at all or think about the past and just be in the moment like the other animals and children are, see how happy they are. But it's a regressive spirituality that is actually rejecting the fundamentally novel human capability that emerged rather than say, let's learn how to use it well for its evolutionary purposes in a fundamentally evolving universe. So if we learn how to use it well...
Okay, so that's the objection that a lot of people have when they hear about mindfulness is, I don't want to dumb myself down. What are you saying? I should stop thinking? Thinking is a wonderful thing that we have evolved to do. Why am I going to throw this away? So what he's saying is that would be a regressive move on the part of human beings. Better to realize that this capacity is it's like a great tool, and we have to learn how to direct this capacity in the best directions. So it's not a question, when you sit in mindfulness, it's not a question of getting rid of your capacity to discriminate. It's a question of understanding how it works and being able to use it rather than have it abuse you. As Ram Dass said, thinking is a wonderful servant and a terrible master. Yeah. And it's a capacity most of us are plagued by rather than a capacity that we use as deftly as we could and as effectively as we could. Abraham.
Yeah, there is an underlying energy here, which is the creative energy that was enacted from the thought.
Yes.
And that thought is very essential for all the stuff that he was saying. The beginning of that creative energy is passed into anything that, you know, you look at the cell, for instance, when the cell divides into two cells, and the two cells divide into two cells, what actually the cell is doing is passing that energy into the other two cells, so the other two cells will be creative. So I would say, to understand what he's saying, that the created become a creator.
Yes.
So yeah. It becomes easy to understand.
Yeah, I think that's the created becomes the creator. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, that's what he's saying. That's the nature of the universe. Okay, let's continue, okay? So the question is, are we gonna forget about our capacity for abstraction, or are we gonna learn to use it?
Then we say, how can we learn from the past, how the universe works, to be able to imagine a future in an omniconsiderate way that has fundamentally less suffering and higher quality of life across all meaningful quality of life metrics for all life, right? That is omniconsiderately true, good, and beautiful. And then how can we apply all that learning now to actually help create that world? And in doing so, we stop just being a part of the whole. But in our ability to think about the whole and think about the direction of the whole, we can actually become an agent for the whole. This is fucking huge, right? The bee is serving this huge role in evolution by pollinating the plants that make the atmosphere that make us. But they don't know they're doing that, and they can't consciously figure out how to do it better. But we actually have the capability of looking at what the whole story is and identifying as, well, the whole evolutionary impulse of the universe brought me about and then woke up to itself in me. And so in a meaningful way, I am actually the evolutionary impulse of the universe awoke to itself in a form that has adequate order of complexity to contemplate that and then get to consciously choose how to participate with it to be not just a board spaceship Earth, but crew, right? To help steer the direction of evolution in cosmos. And so we move from evolution as a mostly unconscious algorithmic process that selects for dominance now to a process that can be mediated by conscious agents that can actually forecast a more beautiful future and select to help create that. Does that make sense?
So we're not just the products of evolution, now we're producing evolution. We're determining the way that evolution goes. And in fact, we have already invented a life form superior to human beings, and it's in your pocket, and it's connected to every other pocket in the world, and it's based on silicon, which is a nice molecule to have life based on, and we're serving it right now by feeding it what it eats, which is information. But I'm just crazy, so. So the point is, we have this capacity to steer evolution or to co-create, you know. And the question is, what are we going to do with that? Are we going to make life on Earth extinct? Because we certainly have that capacity now. Okay, so here we go.
When we don't identify as evolutionaries, then we can be actually kind of, we identify as nouns rather than verbs, and we stay stuck where we're at, and then we need pain as an evolutionary driver, and then emergence through emergency is how we grow. As soon as we identify with the inexorability of evolution and ourselves as evolution incarnate, we stop needing pain to push us because our whole fucking purpose for being, for becoming, being, becoming are actually matched. They're two sides of the same thing. Is the lure of the becoming, is the bringing about more of the timeless properties of the infinite in time, right? More of the infinite through the finite. This actually becomes the basis of our existence. And everybody knows that when you are in the experience of creating beauty that didn't exist before in the universe, that adds to universe, it's uniquely yours to create, you feel a kind of aliveness that's not matched by anything else. In lieu of not doing that, the emptiness
Okay, understand, we're talking about those of you who are creative, that's the creative impulse, okay? And when you do that, when you bring something that into the universe that wasn't there before, when you give birth to something that wasn't there before, you know how that feels. You'd rather be doing that than anything else, and you don't care if they like it or not, you did it. You know, and you want to go do it again. As Beatrice Wood said at 104, I don't know how I drag myself to the wheel every day, but I got to do it. You know? So if you're not currently creative, you might want to think about that as the most kind of vital thing that you can do, both for yourself and for the world, is to bring something new into creation.
Yes.
Okay. So let's go back a little bit here. Hear that? Okay, here we go.
To universe, it's uniquely yours to create. You feel a kind of aliveness that's not matched by anything else. In lieu of not doing that, the emptiness causes all kinds of addiction. Right? Because that's fundamental to what we're actually here to do. Now, when we all identify as evolutionaries, we obsolete the need as pain for a driver. Does that make sense? Because we have a pull driver rather than just being the push driver. When we also identify as fundamentally interconnected parts of an interconnected universe rather than separate things, we stop thinking that there is any definition of success for self that isn't a definition of success for the whole. And we stop thinking that the idea of advantaging ourselves at the expense of something else we're inexorably interconnected to makes sense at all. So we are all agents for an interconnected whole where our sense of self is actually an emergent property of the intersection of this system with the rest of the universe. It's actually key in terms of emergence. Yourself is an emergent property of the whole universe. Because even though you wouldn't exist in the same way without your brain and your body, you also wouldn't exist without the atmosphere and the trees that make it and the plants and bacteria that make it and the gravity and electromagnetism and foundational forces. Like, the concept of I separate from universe is a misnomer. Does that make sense? So the concept of a life path for ourself that isn't a life path for universe is a misnomer. Or advantage for self. So then we get, in the deepest sense, when Einstein said, the idea that there are separate things is an optical delusion of consciousness. And in reality, there's one reality that we call a universe, of which we are all inextricably interconnected facets. And your experience of self is a facet of that. Now, what's so fucking fascinating is that it is interconnected with all of it. It's an expression of the foundation of all of it, and it's also completely unique in all of the universe. It's a unique facet, non-fungibly unique, right? What that means is you have something to offer universe in your experience and your creativity that no one else has to offer exactly that way, which means if you don't offer it, like if Salvador Dali hadn't done Dali, Michelangelo didn't do Dali, Escher wouldn't have done Dali, Dali just wouldn't have happened. And so the universe would have been fundamentally less. So when you get that, your own self-actualization is compulsory, right? You have an obligation to it. But then when you get that everyone else, if they don't self-actualize, universe is less, your participation with helping everyone else self-actualize is also compulsory.
Yes.
So competition is an obsolete concept. Symbiotic, so remember, universe moves towards more differentiation, more novelty, and then more symbiosis across that novelty for more emergence. And what we're moving towards is a civilization where everyone actually identifies this way as an emergent property of the whole, as an interconnected part of the universe with a unique role to play, with unique synergies with all the other unique roles to play. And then with that synergy, with that human participation, then humanity actually becomes a thing. It actually becomes an emergent property. Right now it's an idea, but we don't have humanity, we don't have civilization, we have humans bumping. If we have a bunch of organelles that haven't organized as a cell that starts breathing. Right? You don't have behavior of the whole that is centrally and consciously self-organizing. But we can. And I would actually say, and this is what I wanted to have more time to get into, but to just foreshadow quickly, if we cherry pick from the huge data sets about where humanity is going right now, we can see that things are exponentially changing, which means changing at more and more rapid and more significant rates, And you can cherry pick metrics where things are getting exponentially better, and that's true, and other things are getting exponentially worse, and that's also true. Which means the future that you predict, if you just follow any of those curves, is not happening. If things are getting exponentially better and worse at the same time, does everybody kind of get that that's happening on different metrics? Then that doesn't mean things are getting better or worse. It means the current system is destabilizing. And that means self-terminating. And then we either have a discrete phase shift to a lower order entropic system or the emergence of a higher order system that is foundationally different than the current system we have.
Yes.
In every way. So
it's falling apart. And the question is it going to fall to a more disorganized state, or is it going to come back into a more highly organized state?
Yes.
And that's a huge question right now that you have a major role in determining. Okay, so here we go.
The things getting better are the pieces that can be reorganized to create a new civilization with a foundationally new structure, right? Biosphere metrics are getting exponentially worse from misapplication of technology. Technology's right application are making things fundamentally better, but technology is giving us the capacity to do things like have data analytic capabilities to inventory all the world's resources, to then be able to allocate all the world's resources to meet all the world's needs with optimum efficiency. We never had that ability before. Like the transportation and communication technologies that can actually make us a global civilization, we never had that before, right? And so the technological capacities that require us to step up, otherwise we, self-extinction is a very real thing, also make possible a discrete phase shift in evolution that's characterized by three major things. And this will be where I end. At the level of social systems, primarily economics, the key shift we're going to move to is moving from a differential advantage economy, defined by private ownership, valuation based in scarcity, and differential advantage, to an economic system that is defined by making sure that the incentive of every agent and the well-being of every other agent and the commons is perfectly aligned with no externality. Meaning we actually understand that it's an interconnected system, we identify all the externalities and internalize them, so the system's actually defined by systemic advantage for the whole. It's not communism or socialism or capitalism, it's something that was not possible before to even anticipate. But it is how your body works, where none of the cells are advancing themselves at the expense of the other. They're doing what's best for them, what's best for the whole, symbiotically at the same time, right? And so that's the key net shift at the level of macroeconomics and correspondingly governance and all of our social structures. At the level of infrastructure and the built world, we're moving from a linear materials economy where we extract from the earth at ever-growing rates unsustainably from finite resources and then turn it into trash, to a closed-loop materials economy where the trash is the new stuff. We stop extracting from the earth, stop producing waste, and we actually have a post-growth, negative entropy, closed-loop materials economy where we can live ongoingly a progressively higher and higher quality of life sustainably with the biosphere. So that's the infrastructure shift, that's the social structure shift, and the superstructure, the mimetic shift, is this awareness of all of us as facets of one integrated, self-evolving reality where the well-being of everyone, the well-being of everyone else, the well-being of the commons are not meaningfully calculable separate from each other. Now, what's so interesting is there used to be such a thing as local problems. When Gandhi was working with Home Rule for India, it was largely thought of as an Indian problem, and it didn't directly affect everybody, right? When people in the U.S. wanted to, or who founded the U.S. wanted to leave British Empire, there was somewhere else to go. And it was a local problem. Right now, when we deal with species extinction and ocean acidification and peak nitrogen, peak phosphorus, they're all global issues, and you can't solve them without China and without India, without the U.S., without everyone participating. So the idea that we have local issues is gone. Our level of global infrastructure and technology is made to where we have all global issues. And they are actually existential. They are threatening the biosphere. No one has ever had issues in the history of humanity that threaten the ability of the species to continue. Nor did they have ones that they had to face eminently in short term, nor did they have the capacity to actually face those kinds of things. The data science, the technology that could build something fundamentally new. What that means is we have the most significant work that humanity has ever had, with the most significant capabilities, which also means the most potential to impact the biggest picture that any humans have ever had. And it's easy to think about that and then get caught back into like shit you gotta do next as part of to win at the current system that is going extinct. But winning at a system that is obsoleting the capability of life on Earth to continue, winning at a dying system is not an interesting win. Okay? If you ever think about the definition of heaven, where you're in heaven and there are people in hell and you're happy, you have to be a psychopath. You have to be able to separate from the experience of other sentient things enough that you can be totally stoked with that level of suffering. Well, the idea in this world that the level of intensity of suffering that's happening can be happening and you can just be stoked because you're killing it in your life, you have to be mildly psychopathic. If we want to not be psychopaths, then there is no definition for success for ourselves. It is not definition of success for everything. Now, when we start really taking that seriously, fucking everything changes. And then you start saying, well, what can I actually do to make my life of greatest use to all life? And then your answer to that question, if you take it seriously and really study and really work on it, and don't just like ask the question, get overwhelmed, give up, and go back to current stuff, your progressively better answer to that question will lead to the emergence of your life meaning and dharma and path. And correspondingly, the emergence of civilization making it. That's it.
All right, so let's get the lights up. Okay. Let's see if there's a comment or two about that. You might need to see that one again, but... that's so beautifully stated. So let's have a couple comments. So it's Jeanette and Lau, Jeanette. Quiet folks.
Wait,
do it again.
What I see happening is that there's a shift towards learning to trust and collaborate, or living out of anger and fear and confusion and whatever. But it takes an ability to trust to go to this next.
So what you're saying is there are two things happening at the same time. Some people are kind of contracting. And other people are kind of opening in trust. Yeah, I think that's true. Let's see if people can do it without that. Otherwise, okay, so next is Morty and then Chris.
Well, being a New Yorker, I don't know how, I think he's relating totally to the fucking idiot in the White House who just is doing everything that he's talking about. Divide and conquer, no climate change. In other words, does he play a part in all this? I assume he does.
Oh, absolutely.
Awakening others.
Yeah, to that. Awakening people to the fact that something needs to be done. That business as usual is not the best course, and that people need to stand for something better,
okay. Love.
More inclusive. Yeah. So look, that, you know, it could be a blessing in disguise. Richard Brodigan, the guy that wrote Trout Fishing in America.
Yeah.
Wrote a book called In Watermelon Sugar, which is my favorite of his books, in which he talked about the two kinds of people on the earth, the people who live near I-Death, I-D-E-A-T-H, that is, live near ego-death. They were the evolving people, and he was one of them. And then there were the tigers. And you had to be careful about the tigers, because they were still roaming the earth. And some of the people that are kind of roaming the earth now, I don't call them tigers, I call them dinosaurs.
Right.
And what I tell my kids at school is, you just gotta wait. Hopefully they won't destroy you before they die. And then the kids that are all interconnected through their phones to everybody else around the world, you know, the kids aren't connected to their parents as much as they're connected to their peers. It's a whole different cohort that's coming up that doesn't have those same color blindnesses and prejudices and stuff. They relate to everybody in the world that's like them. They play games with everybody in the world that's like them. And when they rise to positions of power, they won't see these distinctions. So it's just a question of waiting for the tigers or the dinosaurs to plot. Okay, so let's see. Chris, and then Lau.
I'm just thinking, it sounds really beautiful in the way he's saying how nature has a way of
of organizing for the best of the whole.
Yeah.
But sometimes it doesn't work for the best of the whole. In the case of genetic mutation, I know people who were perfectly healthy until out of nowhere this mutation shows up and it's destroying their lives.
Ah, but they die, when mutations are not advantageous, they die out of the population. Okay, mutation is a fact of the universe. Some mutations are good, they are selected for, but some mutations are bad, and so those individuals die off. Unfortunately, the universe isn't just entirely benevolent, it is a dynamic being. So, Abraham.
Yeah, Clive Yogananda said that we live in a world of duality. In other words, we have the positive, we have the negative. And you know, if we concentrate on the positive and ignore the negative is going to sneak up on us and introduce itself in between. So we get to live so we can expect both energies to be manifested. And he was just saying that, you know, focus on the positive and forget about the negative.
I don't think that's what he was saying, actually. I think what he was saying is the interplay of forces in the universe creates an evolving universe.
Yeah.
Yin and Yang don't exist separately, but when you put them together, you get something beyond either of them. You get the whole. And then the whole evolves. Okay, so we got to get out of here, kids. thank Ami for bringing that to our attention. And if you want to see it again, it's Daniel Schmachtenberger.
Yes.
Okay, we'll see you next week.
Thank you.